And welcome everybody to the Crystal Ball Run podcast. You can check out the website, of course, at crystalballrun.com. Follow it along on Twitter at crystalballrun. Like it on Facebook at facebook.com/crystalballrun. Of course, I'm Kevin McGuire here with you. We missed out last week, but we're back stronger than ever. We've got a great guest today. Well, not really a guest. He's going to be a part of this show going forward, you know, as we've been changing things around on the website. So this is a voice you may not have heard for a while. And, you know, I don't know if you've heard anywhere else before. If you haven't, you're missing out because he's really a great guy to talk about some college football. And very happy to have him be a part of this moving forward. Aaron Torres, how's it going, my man?
Kevin, it's really good. I would hope that, you know, that anybody listening to the show would have somewhat, you know, somewhat of a background on my work. Obviously, working with you at Crystal Ball Run for so many years now. And, you know, I'm really flattered that you were the person who kind of took over for myself and Alan Kenny. And the site is in spectacular hands, I would say. And although I'm not writing and contributing as much as I have in the past, I'm always very in tune with what's going on in college football. And I look forward to chatting a little week two with you today.
Aaron, of course, is one of the co-founders of this website, Crystal Ball Run. He was one of the, he, along with Alan, really got this website put together, really put together the team. So he took a very influential part in getting this site off the ground, and hopefully we can continue moving forward. And like I said, Aaron, we're going to try and keep you a part of this and at least give you an outlet to talk about some college football, because I know you may not have the same kind of voice you used to have in this whole blogosphere in the college football world, but we know you're doing some good things with Fox Sports One. I've said it before, I'll say it again. And it's been a joy to watch so far. I'm really enjoying Fox Sports Live, and I'm not just saying that for you. I really do mean it. So I look forward to seeing what you guys have going forward in the rest of the season. I'm sure you'll keep us all up to date on that as well.
Yeah, it's been a good run since I kind of, you know, one of the big reasons I kind of gave back some of the reins to Fox Sports or to Crystal Ball Run is strictly because I am working now for Fox Sports Live, television show on the new Fox Sports One. It's been a lot of fun. I have been challenged to learn a lot about sports that I knew nothing about before, such as the chase for the NASCAR championship. And as you know, I follow baseball loosely. I've had to kind of follow it a lot more closely. And I actually sat down and watched a little NFL football yesterday, which is a little not in tune with what I usually do. I much prefer the college game. But as I said, working for Fox Sports Live now, I have to be well-versed in every sport. However, college football is still kind of where my passion lies, where my most interest is. You know, when I have free time, like I do a little bit today, that's what I'm reading about. You know, the Manny Diaz, Lane Kiffin, Aaron Murray, Brian Kelly, Brady Hoke, Devin Gardner. I mean, that's the stuff that really kind of just gets me going. And, you know, as I mentioned 100 times, college football is where my passion's at. So, I really do, in all seriousness, appreciate you having me on the podcast, keeping me involved, because, as you said, I still have a lot to say on college football, and I'm really glad that you're giving me a forum to do so.
Absolutely. I couldn't ask for a better partner with this going forward. So you touched on a number of the big stories in college football today. You know, you mentioned Notre Dame, you mentioned Georgia, you mentioned Texas. I think you mentioned USC somewhere in there. We're going to talk about all of that stuff, at least a little bit brief. I don't know if we'll go into a whole lot of detail with a lot of stuff, but we really want to get some of the opinions out there. And, you know, Aaron, I'm going to give you a choice. Do you want to start with the good that we saw in college football this past weekend, or do you want to start with the bad?
Well, I am a glasses half full kind of guy. I am an optimist. I think the interesting stories are actually with the negative, but let's start with the good. Let's start with the good. We're a positive, you know, look at the best that is of college football. So let's start with the positive. Where are you going to take me?
First of all, I'm so happy you said that, because I like to look at the glass half full as well. I'm looking at a glass of water on my desk right now, and I'm seeing it's half full. So let's talk about some of the good. You know, I think one of the biggest games this past weekend, and more important games, is probably that Georgia-South Carolina game. If you look at what Georgia did the opening week against Clemson, Aaron Murray took a little bit of the heat for the way that game played out. He didn't have a particularly great game. You know, Georgia was in it, of course, but Clemson ends up winning that game in week one. So you really wanted to see what was going to happen with this Georgia team. You know, we always talk about the pressure that's on Mark Richt as a head coach there, whether it's deserved or not. That's a completely other topic. Obviously, a lot of criticism for Aaron Murray throughout his career, despite being one of the top quarterbacks in the conference in the SEC, preseason first team all SEC quarterback. So, you know, I don't really know where the criticism really comes from, but I guess he's looking for some of those big wins. You know, I think he's won some big games before, and certainly I think what he did against South Carolina was probably one of his finest moments.
Yeah, you know, and a guy who's actually now a colleague of mine at Fox Sports, and a guy who everyone who follows college football really well knows is Clay Travis. And I thought he really had kind of the best point on this that I've heard. And it's something that makes sense, but isn't something you necessarily think about. And that's this, is to play in big games, to play in games that matter, you have to win a lot of the other games. You know, to get to an SEC championship game, you have to beat the Kentuckys and the Vanderbilts. And, you know, last year in the case of Georgia, it was the Floridas and the Ole Misses and whoever you have to beat. You still got to win a lot of games to play those big games. And yeah, I didn't necessarily think that all the criticism of Aaron Murray was totally fair. You know, the kid, first of all, let's get one thing straight. I believe he threw for over 300 yards against Clemson a few weeks back, excuse me. So it's not like he was terrible. Right. And, you know, you go back to last year's SEC championship game, he was phenomenal. We all know that Georgia was possibly one play short of playing for and very likely winning a national championship last year. So I didn't necessarily buy into that, but it was still nice to see the guy. Yes, it was at home. Yes, South Carolina is still kind of trying to figure out a few things about themselves, but it was nice for this guy to kind of get this monkey off his back. As you and I kind of both said, it's not necessarily fair that he has this criticism, you know, especially for a 22-year-old college kid that's won a ton of games. You know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I suspect he'll go down as one of the winningest quarterbacks in Georgia history if he kind of continues on the trajectory for the rest of this season. So didn't think it was necessarily fair, but good to see him put up just a really brilliant effort against South Carolina. Obviously, he had some help, Todd Gurley in specific.
Absolutely.
And you know, unbelievable effort by both of them. And credit Georgia. You know, we all kind of know what was at stake for them this past week in terms of it really being basically a make-or-break game for their entire season. We all know if they had lost, they basically would have been out of the title hunt. But they won, and you know what? They're right back in it because we all know that the last two BCS national champions have had one loss, and it's come from the SEC. It's been Alabama. They've had a loss in conference. So Georgia right now really does kind of control its own destiny very likely in the BCS title race. There's obviously a ton of football to be played, but with that said, had they lost, it would have been a completely different ball game. But Georgia is in great shape going forward, and you know, that's really what that win was all about for them.
Yeah, it was really a big win because I don't know what the psyche would have been if they had gone 0-2, and I'm not necessarily saying that would have roll them out of the whole SEC picture. I think that would be ridiculous because there's only one game in conference play. There's so much football to be played. So I wouldn't necessarily write them off if they started 0-2. But you wonder where the season would go if they did get off to that bad start. And I'm not saying one thing would have happened or another, but it's one of those things I think we'd be curious to see how they would respond from that situation. But you know, fortunately for them, they are 1-1. They got some momentum back on their favor, and they got some confidence, and I think that's going to be huge for them going forward. Like we said, there's plenty of football to be played. And you never know if there's going to be a slip up somewhere along the way. Obviously, they'll still have to play Florida in division play, and Tennessee's actually looking pretty decent. Mm-hmm. So who knows what's going to happen with that game? Further down the line, another one of the big games this weekend, Aaron, was the Miami Florida game, and that's one that I was paying closer attention to in the early slated games. I don't know how much of a chance you got to watch it, but of course. There's two ways we talk about this one. We're focusing on the good, though. So we're going to talk a little bit about Miami and what this means for Al Golden moving forward. If you want to throw in some of the bad as Florida, as it pertains to Florida, that's fine. But I think it was a pretty solid win for Miami. I think it's something that they really needed to go forward. And again, this doesn't really say too much about what's going to happen in ACC play, but I think getting that win against Florida at home, that could be something that they can build off of going forward.
Yeah, you know, and I am a positive guy, and I am looking at my own glass of water that's half full, but I actually think the story here is Florida because Miami, you know, Miami was at home, and Miami didn't really do a lot to win this game. You know, Florida, I did watch a lot of this game, and you know, Florida, I think we were all kind of curious about what their offense would look like, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think you'd actually make the case that it might be worse than last year, which is obviously really problematic for a team that, as you said before, needs to compete with Georgia and South Carolina and the SEC East. Tennessee's coming on. They play LSU. I don't want to take anything away from Miami, but it's not like Miami went out and just blindsided them and you know, put up a BYU like 600 yards of total offense. You know what I mean? Like Miami played a good game, They scored enough points needed to win. They hit that one really big play. I believe it was to Phil Dorsett in the passing game. I'm not totally sure. But, you know, I think the bigger story to me is just that Florida doesn't seem to have anything figured out offensively. And, you know, you lose Mike Gillisley from last year, and you know, you knew there was going to be some rough patches. But Florida really doesn't have any excuses after that game. You know, Jeff Driscoll, another year, doesn't seem to really have many options in the vertical passing game. I don't know if that's a Jeff Driscoll problem or a wide receiver problem. But, you know, Florida had their full complement of running backs. Matt Jones was back. And they just weren't able to move the ball. And so, I don't want to take away anything from Miami. I think it was a great win for a program. You know, I know you follow Al Golden closely because you've covered Temple in the past. And after everything he's been through, I'm happy for him and I'm happy for that program. But I do think that the talking point here is Florida and the fact that a year later, a year after 11 wins and a Sugar Bowl appearance, they just don't look like they're any better than they were last year. And as I kind of mentioned, I don't know how they're going to compete with those upper echelon SEC teams that we've already discussed.
Yeah, I will fully acknowledge that Florida played, I want to say they played the better game when you look at the yardage and the way that they moved the football, because they certainly were able to move into the red zone and they had plenty of opportunities. It's just a matter of the fact that Florida kept shooting themselves in the foot. They kept turning the football over. They couldn't do anything with it to really take advantage of those situations. And I'll give credit to Miami for having the players in position when they needed to be there to take advantage of those missed opportunities for Florida. But if you're Florida, you have to be looking at that game film this week and you have to be thinking, oh man, we really should have won this game and it really probably shouldn't have been that close, because I think Miami only had a little over 200 yards of offense. And when you hold your opponent to that little yardage, odds are you're probably going to win the game most times.
Yeah, no, absolutely, man. And that's kind of where my disappointment creeps in, is just like, again, I defended Florida. I thought this year was going to be different. And I got to be honest, until you mentioned the yardage disparity, I mean, I knew it was bad, but when Florida basically doubled Miami's production, you know, offensively, had more than twice as many first downs, and you're just not able to score, you know, that's a headache upon a headache. And I don't know what to say, man. It's like, it's not going to get any easier. Miami has good players on defense, but they don't have the kind of players that South Carolina does and LSU does and Georgia does. And it could be a long season for Florida. I don't know that there are answers kind of on this offense to really get things going. And if that's the case, you kind of wonder what's next for this program and, you know, kind of what their ceiling as a team is, you know?
Yeah, that really was Florida's problem last year. They just didn't have playmakers, at least on offense. And that certainly is looking like the case early on this year. You know, Miami, I think, is going to be pretty interesting to watch going forward now, because like I said, it seems like a win that they can sort of build off of. And obviously they're going to have a tough challenge ahead of them going into the season. But I think when you put together a game like that, and let's keep in mind, you know, that's 2 weeks in a row where the ACC had a pretty significant win over the SEC. Clemson over Georgia, like we mentioned earlier, was huge in week one. I think Miami's win against Florida certainly sends a little bit of a message, not just to the SEC, maybe a little bit, but certainly to the rest of the ACC. You know, the pressure's on. This is a conference that needs to put together these kinds of wins as we move forward, with where schedule strength is going to come into play a little bit too.
I was going to say, you know who knows about all these big ACC wins over the SEC is Dabo Swinney, man. Like, yeah, you talk about it. Yeah, first of all, I said this on Twitter and I stand by it. Dabo Swinney, he may coach in the SEC, but he's got some SEC level swag going for him. And the, you know, flashing the U sign as he walked out of the press conference, I love it. You know, and credit to the ACC. I'm all for more good teams in college football. Like, listen, I have no problem with nine teams or whatever. You know, what was it last year? Like six teams in the SEC winning nine games, or seven teams or whatever it ended up being. But I'm happy when Miami's good. I'm happy when Clemson's good. I'm happy when Ohio State is good. I'm happy when the balance of power shifts, because that means that we have more important games coming down the home stretch in November and early December, whereas in years past, it really has seemed like once we kind of hit that first week in November, there haven't been a ton of games that mean a lot, other than maybe a couple in the SEC and, you know, maybe an Oregon or Oregon and Stanford in the Pac-12. I mean, it just doesn't seem like there's a lot of meaningful games. So more good teams mean more games that you and I and other guys are forced to watch. I hope it continues, man. Like I said, I think it's good for college football when Miami's good. How good they actually are, I don't know. I still think they're an upper echelon SEC or ACC team. I don't really know what it means necessarily in the grand scheme. Like I said, I just don't know where Florida kind of fits into the puzzle themselves. But, hey, I'm all for it, man. More good teams, more good games, more compelling games. More reason for us to watch as fans.
Yeah, I'm certainly not throwing Miami into the pile with Alabama and Oregon at this point in time, but I will throw them in the mix with Clemson and Florida State as far as the ACC is concerned. One thing we noted before the season started is since Miami joined the ACC, they have not played in an ACC championship game yet. They could have played last year, of course, but they decided to sit out the postseason on their own decision. Obviously, that's a cloud that we'll have to hopefully clear up someday. We can talk about that another time, though. We'll just move forward and see what happens with Miami. You said it's good when programs like Ohio State and Miami are good in football. It's also good when programs like Notre Dame and Michigan are good in football. And obviously last year, Notre Dame making the undefeated run through the regular season, getting to the BCS championship game. They start off 1-0 this season. Of course, not exactly the same kind of team that we saw last year. But Michigan also is looking like they're a pretty good team, and a lot of people are now talking about them maybe emerging as the best team in the Big Ten. Aaron, are you buying that Michigan is now your team to beat in the Big Ten? Why or why not?
That's a great question. I hadn't even necessarily really thought about it per se, but I think you can make a pretty compelling case because you kind of look at Michigan last year, and they were a touchdown away from beating Ohio State in what basically boiled down to like Devin Gardner's second or third game as a starting quarterback. I don't remember the exact number, but what I do remember is that Devin Gardner had kind of taken over about mid-October when Denard Robinson went down and really kind of proved to be a competent and capable leader and was really good down the stretch. And you and I both watch a lot of Big Ten football, because we're masochists like that and because we have nothing better to do. And it's like, but if you watched him last year, he was actually really good. And the fact is, and then you factor in, like I said, they nearly beat Ohio State at Ohio State, which is something that I don't think a lot of people realize. You know, a lot of people remember that Jadeveon Clowney play from I believe it was the Outback Bowl, whatever bowl it was. They remember the Jadeveon Clowney play. What they don't remember is that Michigan was in that game and nearly beat South Carolina, lost by 5 points. So,
that's a very good point. A lot of people do forget that.
Yeah, so I mean, it's funny, Kevin, because I hadn't really thought, is Michigan, quote unquote, the best team in the Big Ten until you bring it up. But when you start putting the pieces together from last year, it starts to make sense. And I like Ohio State, but Ohio State hasn't looked invincible. We all know that Braxton Miller isn't at 100%, might not play this weekend. Even if he does play, who knows what he's going to be like, in terms of his physical condition by the time Ohio State and Michigan get together. So I think it's a great point by you. And again, I hadn't really thought about it until you kind of proposed it to me right now. But I think you can make a very compelling case that after a very impressive showing against Notre Dame, a reasonably manageable schedule going forward, Ohio State at home, as I mentioned, I think you can make a pretty good case that this Michigan team might actually be the best team in the Big Ten.
Yeah, I'm still going to hedge my bet on Ohio State. Now, I'm going to assume that Braxton Miller will be playing for the majority of this season. And if that's the case, I still think the Buckeyes are going to be very tough for anyone in this conference to beat. But at least if you look on Michigan's side of the division, okay, Northwestern's off to a pretty decent start. I think some people are high on them. I'm not really buying into them as much as some people are. But, I think Michigan would be able to take Northwestern. Michigan State has absolutely no offense. Nebraska has looked a little shaky out of the gate, so who knows what Nebraska is also a team that can lose any game on their schedule as far as I'm concerned, so certainly wouldn't think that they would be the runaway favorite, even though our preseason picks, I'm pretty sure I have Nebraska playing in the Big Ten championship. But Michigan has certainly started strong, and you can't ask for much more out of them for that. It was a pretty exciting game, I think, against Notre Dame. I know you didn't get a chance to watch it so much, but what I think the big takeaway from that game, there's two things, really. The emergence of Devin Gardner and really what he's meaning for this offense is they get back into that more traditional style that I think suits them better. And, of course, Eminem's appearance in the broadcast booth.
Oh, we saw that, man. We saw that. That stopped the whole newsroom at Fox Sports Live in terms of when Eminem came on the screen. We all saw it. I haven't had a chance to read Richard Deitch's column on what it all means for the media landscape or anything like that, but that was bizarre, man. Like, I don't even know what to say. There's no really analysis to be had out of that. I don't really know what Eminem was on per se when he was in that interview, but Brent Musburger seen it. You know, my favorite thing, by the way, about that whole thing was I believe Brent Musburger asked one question and Kirk Herbstreit said, "All right, are you ready to throw it to break?" Which in TV lingo, I can tell you now that I've been working in TV for 2 months, I can tell you all about it, is "Get me the F out of here." That was Kirk Herbstreit saying, "Get me the F out of here. I don't know what the heck is going on, but this guy is not in the right frame of mind." And that was, I would argue, as entertaining as anything that happened this past weekend in college football was Eminem's appearance in the press box there.
Yeah, it certainly lit up Twitter for no doubt about that. You know, just a couple of other good notes to leave on before we talk about some of the more negative stuff that's going on right now. Teddy Bridgewater and Taj Boyd look pretty good. Johnny Manziel in the 6 quarters of football he's played looks pretty decent as well. If you had to take one quarterback right now, Aaron, based on just 2 weeks, I know it's a small sample size. You can take in last season for consideration if you want. But if you had to take one quarterback out there right now, who's been the most impressive to you?
Most impressive. Okay, so that's the question, not who's going to have the most successful season, not who's going to play in the best bowl game, just who's been the most impressive.
Yeah, let's say if you had to take one right now, who's been the most impressive over the last 2 weeks? And, you know, we'll see what happens in the future.
Okay, that's a great question. I am going to surprise some people. I'm sure I'm going to upset some people. I'm actually going to say Mr. Johnny Football, Johnny Manziel. And that's not to take away from what Taj Boyd did against Georgia. That's not to take away what Teddy Bridgewater's done in 2 games. But I think that you know, as I was kind of, you know, I kind of had that Sam Houston State game on in the background. And, like, you know, Sam Houston State, we're not obviously taking anything away from that game in terms of, you know, what does it mean in the national championship picture and all that stuff. But it's like I was just watching that game and watching highlights later on in the night, and I was like, you know, I forgot with all the crap that happened this offseason how fun Johnny Football is to watch. And maybe it was just because that Rice game was on national TV and because everybody kind of was tuned in. You know, it turned into something negative in terms of, you know, Johnny Manziel flashing the money signs and Johnny Manziel, right, you know, taunting the other team and bumping into Kevin Sumlin, or Kevin Sumlin bumped into him, or whatever it was. But, you know, you just kind of forget the fact that this guy is, like, really fun to watch to play football. And again, I know it's Sam Houston State, but the guy looked dynamite in the pocket, is as elusive as ever running the ball. You know, it sets up perfectly. I'm sure we'll talk later, A&M Alabama. But yes, I just have to say, like, it's not to take anything away from the other guys. I don't think Manziel is going to win the Heisman. I think he may get shut up this weekend. But just through 2 games, like, I just think that with everything that happened this offseason, it was so easy to forget how fun it is to watch Johnny Football play. And, you know, taking out all the off-the-field stuff, I've really enjoyed it through 2 weeks.
Well, Aaron, as we do these podcasts throughout the season, at the end of every month, I'm going to ask you for your take on who the most impressive team has been. So I just want you to think about that going forward. And we're not going to talk about the most impressive team after two games, but I want you to keep that in mind.
I do have a pseudo answer for that.
By all means, go ahead.
Okay, and I would be curious for you, as you know, just your own personal opinion on that one. But, sure. You know, so I was a big proponent of – I am a big proponent of the new head coach with the Philadelphia Eagles, Chip Kelly. And I was one of those people, and I, you know, maybe even in the minority, in saying that I didn't think that the Oregon program was good enough or sound enough or you know, bulletproof enough to just roll on and keep doing what they had been doing without Chip Kelly. So for them to do what they did, specifically last weekend against Virginia, and I know Virginia is not an upper echelon ACC team. I know we've already talked about, you know, kind of where the ACC is in the college football pecking order. But for Oregon to fly across country the week before that, they know they have a huge game against Tennessee, and I think that's going to be a really good game. But for them to fly across country and just put on a clinic, man, and, like, were they flawless? No. They had, you know, a couple little miscues. They couldn't convert a fourth down in the red zone. But, my God, man, like, it really does just seem like it is business as usual for them. They do not seem to have missed a beat without Chip Kelly. You know, it'll be interesting when the games get bigger and the pressure mounts and, you know, Mark Helfrich has to make those important decisions kind of in the fourth quarter that dictate the entire season. You know, we'll kind of see what he is and what this team is made of. But for them, yes, I expected them to be 2-0, but I can't lie and say that I expected them to look this good. I expect them to effortlessly score points against what I think is a half-decent Virginia team. Like, I thought they were going to win that game, but I didn't think it was going to be like that. So credit to Oregon. Have they been kind of quote-unquote the most impressive team in college football? I don't know, but they've impressed me with kind of the ability to kind of just keep this thing going without Chip Kelly.
I will say that as far as Oregon's concerned, I actually expected them to not have as much of a drop-off as maybe people may have expected. Having said that, I don't know if I expected quite the same kind of look from them initially. I'm a little surprised at how similar they do look. It's almost like as if they can plug in a coach and the system is there, ready to go. I don't think that's actually the case, but just looking at them after two games, that again, the level of competition isn't exactly the best, but they look very similar. And I'll give Helfrich a lot of credit for taking what these players know, what they learned under Chip Kelly, and continuing moving forward with it, because it obviously works. The big concern I will have will be later in the year, what's going to happen when they go up a team that's going to be able to play a little bit more physical defense like we've seen from Stanford the last couple of years, really, and how does he challenge that? Like, you kind of address that. Like, what's he going to do in those real game crunch time decision making opportunities? That's something that we'll have to just wait and see. Given his first two opponents, he didn't have to do a whole lot, I don't think, because he had such an advantage with the speed, the athleticism of the players that he has, and obviously they look pretty good. There's no doubt about that. They're obviously opening a lot of eyes as far as that's concerned. To fly across country, though, and dominate the way they did, it's not easy for any team. There's only a few teams that are able to do that, and they're usually your elite teams, and I think Oregon right now is among the elite. Are they equipped to go head to head with an Alabama? I don't know, but I would love to see it.
Well, all I would really add to that is, you know, you talk about teams that are physical and all that stuff, and I think we're going to find out really quick this weekend against Tennessee, because I'm not saying Tennessee is quote-unquote back. I'm not having that conversation, but one thing that Derek Dooley did leave for Butch Jones, and to his credit, Butch Jones is taking advantage of it, is a lot of veterans on the defense and specifically the offensive line, and you watched Tennessee this weekend, and I know it was only Western Kentucky, and they've had really two kind of no-name opponents, but Western Kentucky went ahead and beat Kentucky 2 weeks ago, and that's an SEC team no matter how you break it down. They very well might be the worst team in the SEC, but it is still an SEC team nonetheless. And, you know, the one thing that Tennessee does have is big physical guys along the front line. You know, we'll talk about them later. I don't really know that I have any more opinion other than to say that I think Tennessee can physically kind of control the line of scrimmage against Oregon. It's just kind of a matter of, you know, are they going to be able to stop the big plays on defense? That's something I don't know. But I think that for Oregon, this is going to be a big test this weekend. And let me tell you this, if they put up a 48 spot, or, you know, if they kind of keep doing what they've been doing against this Tennessee club, then I think you've got to put them right in the discussion with Alabama and anybody else for the best team in college football. But that obviously remains to be seen in, you know, in the coming days and, you know, as they get ready for this Tennessee game.
Well, I'm high on Tennessee. I'm a fan of Butch Jones. I really think that he's going to be a guy that gets that program back on track. I don't know if he'll be the guy that leads them to the top of the SEC, but they're certainly not going to be one of those bottom feeders and kind of a joke in the conference. But I want to use that as a transition into some of the bad, because Tennessee, they won, and I'm not going to take anything away from them, but Western Kentucky, what was it, 5 turnovers on 6 plays? I don't know if any team has ever done that before, but that was certainly one of the lowlights of the weekend as far as I'm concerned. I was surprised that Western Kentucky came out and played that sloppy.
You know, it's funny, when you said we're going to transition to some of the bad, I just assumed that you would take Tennessee's coach from about 5 years ago and go in that direction.
We're going to get that in a second. I just wanted to
In terms of Western Kentucky, man, like, there's not a ton to take away from it. Like, like, Tennessee's a way better team, but, man, you're right. Western Kentucky, 5 turnovers in 6 plays or 5 turnovers in 7, whatever it was really bad. It was surprising for two reasons, I think. One, because Bobby Petrino coached teams. I know he's only been there a few months, but, like, that guy's team doesn't beat itself. And, like, when he was at Arkansas – yeah, they got beat up by Alabama pretty good. They occasionally got beat up by LSU pretty good. But it was never just by their own mistakes. It was because the other team just had better football players than them. You know, so that was one thing that was surprising to me, is just the fact that team kind of – we mentioned it with Florida before, but that Western Kentucky kind of kept shooting itself in the foot. The other kind of takeaway I had from that game, in terms of the bad, I kind of lost my train of thought here, but again, it just comes back to Tennessee. And what I guess I was going to say was, is that the second takeaway was that Tennessee was a team that could never, you know, get positive momentum going. I think that was really a huge takeaway for me, is that Tennessee under Derek Dooley was always the team that turned the ball over themselves, always the team that had their hand on the interception and dropped it, always was the team that had the interception and the next play they would turn it over themselves. You know, so for like Butch Jones to turn Tennessee into like this team that is just doing all these positive things and creating their own momentum, I mean, that's what was most surprising to me, is that just wasn't Tennessee's MO under Derek Dooley. And I was a Derek Dooley apologist, but man, and like Butch Jones, just like he has his team going and he has his team playing smart football. And that's something that as much as I like Derek Dooley, you could not say that about Derek Dooley. They were never smart. They never made, you know, the correct decision. They never forced their opponents into dumb decisions. And that's something that Butch Jones has certainly changed in just a couple short weeks as the head coach there.
Yeah, again, I'm sure we're going to be talking about Tennessee throughout the season, because I don't think that they're going to be going away, and they're going to be a team that we're going to be paying close attention to, watching them turn that corner. But let's continue like that discussion you were assuming we were going into, and it is the big topic right now, I think, and it's something we're going to be talking a little bit about on crystalballrun.com later this week, maybe later today, maybe tomorrow, depending on when you're listening to this. USC and Texas, I think, both had two of the worst weekends of the week. USC losing at home to Washington State, 10-7. They don't even put together 200 yards of offense. Texas with no run defense, giving up 550 yards on the ground to BYU, a program I think most people would associate with passing, but but you know, they've shown an ability to run the ball, and certainly they put on a clinic Saturday night. Of course, the fallout, about less than 24 hours later, Texas makes the early season change with defensive coordinator. And Aaron, when you're changing your defensive coordinator after two games in your season, what does that mean to you?
It means that Mack Brown is in a world of trouble. And, you know, it was really interesting to me, because I was, you know, with my girlfriend at the time, or, you know, a lady that I'm seeing, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, we all know how this stuff works. And Twitter basically stopped when that happened. And, you know, she was with me, and she's kind of like, well, what's going on? You know, and I was like, well, and I explained the situation to her. And I said, you know, there's a guy that runs the defense. He's called the defensive coordinator. And Texas just fired their defensive coordinator. And she said, well, was he that bad, or was it just, you know, she asked a very, I thought, astute question. She said, well, was he that bad, or is the coach just trying to cover his own butt? And I said, you know, that's a great question, and it's a little bit of both. I really think it was. Like, yes, Manny Diaz, it was bad. But I think that if Mack Brown really had confidence in not only Manny Diaz's ability, but also Mack Brown's own ability himself, then I don't think this would have happened. You know, and this to me reeks of desperation, reeks of trying to pawn off the responsibility on somebody else. Yes, Manny Diaz is a defensive coordinator, but you know what? At the end of the day, it still falls back on the head coach. Just like Lane Kiffin is on the hot seat. They went 7-6 last year. It may have been the defense's fault last year, but you know what? It still reflects on Lane Kiffin. Just because he changed the defensive coordinator doesn't make him any less on the hot seat. And I know it's not good comparison, but I'm just kind of making it in broad terms. And like I said, to me, if you're Mack Brown, you know, he's sitting here saying in his press conference on Sunday, well, I didn't see any adjustments from Manny Diaz, you know, after watching the game film. Well, you know, isn't that something that you should be addressing in Provo? Isn't that something you should be addressing at halftime in the third quarter? I don't know. To me, you know, you asked me the question, what does it mean? It just means that I just think that Mack Brown is out of answers, and now he's just grasping at straws here. The funny thing is, I don't think this program is as far off as a lot of other people do. I mean, they won 9 games last year, and you know, you can't ever make an excuse for Texas giving up 629 yards or 679 yards, whatever it was, and 558 or whatever it was on the ground. But I don't think this program is as far off as people think it is. But, man, when you fire your defensive coordinator 2 games in the season, it really kind of reflects on where Mack Brown thinks this program is and kind of the concerns he has going forward.
Yeah, I hate to overreact just to one game. It looked really bad, though. Like some of us have been saying, you know, it wasn't all that long ago, really, where we were seeing USC and Texas in the BCS championship game, and you look at where these programs are right now, you're left scratching your head a little bit. Like, you're thinking, like, has time really flown that far where these programs have really fallen off that far? Obviously, USC had their sanctions that they had to play through, and obviously that has an effect on what the product is right now. You know, you can't say the same for Texas. I mean, Texas has basically everything they could ask for. They've got the resources. They've got their own network. There's no problems with financial support there. So obviously, I think it does come down to coaching. And, you know, Mack Brown may be a good coach, but, you know, is he starting to enter the territory where we're saying, and I hate to make these comparisons or suggest this, but I'm just throwing it out there. Is it almost something where we're saying maybe the game has passed Mack Brown?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you can't say that. And, right. You know, to me, you know, I think this is something that a lot of us have talked about through the years. I mean, was Mack Brown that good, or was he just, you know, kind of the byproduct, or was he kind of lucky enough to just have two transcendent quarterbacks in back-to-back, you know, kind of classes that really you know, that really just basically put the programs on their back? Because if you remember kind of DeVince Young's early years in that program, what was the knock on Chip Kelly, or knock on Chip Kelly, knock on Mack Brown, is that Mack Brown can't win the big one, and they could never beat Oklahoma. And then Vince Young got them over that hump. They had a year that was a little bit down, and then Colt McCoy got them right back up on that national pedestal. So, you know, this is a program that since Mack Brown's early days haven't really been great at developing kind of playmakers in the sense of like elite running backs or wide receivers. They had Ricky Williams, they had Cedric Benson, haven't really had anybody since then. You know, after Roy Williams left at Texas, hasn't really had that elite receiver other than Jordan Shipley. So to me, I don't know if I don't know if the sport has passed him by. I think it's a few things. I think one, frankly, I just think it's a lot harder to win in the Big 12 than it was. And, you know, you look across the landscape, Mike Gundy has Oklahoma State in a great place. Baylor is significantly better than they were even 3 or 4 years ago, let alone 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago when he started. You know, you go across the board, Iowa State is more competitive. Kansas State with Bill Snyder back is more competitive. So I think, one, it's just harder to get wins. And two, I just don't know if he was ever that good, or he just had really, really good players. And when you start missing out and recruiting on some of these guys, then all of a sudden, you know, the gap starts to kind of narrow. And, you know, I know it's been kind of a fun talking point, but, you know, he obviously completely misevaluated Robert Griffin and Johnny Manziel and, you know, a bunch of other guys through the years. And, you know, you just wonder maybe with the quarterback specifically, if he's just made some wrong choices, and was he that good of a coach, or was he just a byproduct of, you know, a couple really good players? That I don't know. You know, honestly, I'd be really curious to know what your take is, because I don't know that there is one easy kind of cookie cutter answer.
Yeah, I don't think there is either. I think there's so many problems, I think, with you know, with where Texas is right now. And I think a lot of the expectations and maybe the plans for this program have just not played out the way that they probably expected. Real quick, the one thing that you just said towards the end there with the Mack Brown recruiting jokes with Johnny Manziel and Robert Griffin, to me, it almost seems like the Mack Brown recruiting jokes are this year's version of Mark Richt has lost control of for this.
Oh, yeah, so, absolutely.
But, yeah, I mean, you look at what Texas has. Like I said, they've got their own network, and I think a lot of people expected that was really going to be a game changer for them, and it turned out to be kind of a tipping point for where we are in college football today, but it hasn't necessarily played to the benefit of Texas probably the way we were led to believe. You know, maybe this is going to be some kind of recruiting chip. You know, maybe that is for some people, for some players.
Yeah, no, and what's really interesting about it is basically the Longhorn Network is basically what pushed Texas A&M into right. The SEC. And, you know, we all know this now. It's not a secret to anybody. We all understand kind of the ramifications of that. I still don't think that it's as big of a deal as people make it out to be. I still think that, you know, look, in terms of where Texas stands, at this point, I don't think Mack Brown's the guy. And I really thought, okay, you know, younger team. You know, they have made – listen, the one thing about them is they have made strides over the past 3 years. They went from 5 wins to 8 wins to 9 wins, mm-hmm. starting, you know, in the year after – the years after Colt McCoy left. So it's not like there hasn't been improvement. But this was really the year that I thought, okay, they jump back into the Big 12 title picture. Do I think that they can compete with Alabama on a neutral field? No. Did I think that – no. But who can? You know what I mean? Right. And it's like – but I thought that they would be like a fringe, you know, a fringe top 10. Go 10-2, go to the Fiesta Bowl and kind of just be back in kind of that bigger picture discussion of where we are. The fact that they're not really leads me to believe that, you know what, maybe Mac Brown just isn't that guy. And I talk about it a lot. I've defended him. I've been somewhat of an apologist. Whatever terminology you want to use, you know, I've sort of defended Mac Brown, and now it's just not there. But I also think that in terms of this whole Longhorn network, and I know you're not, you know, talking in such big, broad terms, but, you know, I don't think it's a tipping point for anything. I still think that if the Texas job were to be on the open market, I still think that it would attract as good of a pool of candidates as any job in the country. Yes, that the Longhorn Network's a little bit of a different animal in its own right. I know that Mac has complained in the past about some of the media commitments that come with it. I know that fans have been frustrated that you know, you can't get some of Texas's games because they're only on the Longhorn Network. But I do still think that if the Texas job opened up this year, I think we'd be stunned to hear some of the names that would be interested in taking it. And I don't know who that answer is. I don't really know what the pool of guys will be this year. You know, we've talked about in the past, like, if Chip Kelly wasn't to work for some reason, you know, in the pros, if he came back, that would be kind of a great landing point for him because of his recruiting abilities in Texas. And my point is that I don't think that this is like the end of the world for Texas and that they'll never compete for another national championship again. I do think the game may have passed Mac Brown by, and I do think that he might not ever be the guy to get them back to a national championship game. But if we learn anything in recent college football memory, it's that Kevin Sumlin just won 11 games with somebody else's players last year. Jim Mora just won 9 games with somebody else's players last year. Urban Meyer won 12 games with somebody else's players. And if you get the right guy in to that program, again, I don't know who that guy is, I do think that Texas is right back in the conversation as soon as they get that right guy. And I think with the right coach, you could talk about them as a legitimate national championship contender in just 2 to 3 years, because that's how good this program is. That's how you know, how much they have going for it in terms of resources, in terms of recruiting potential, all that stuff. So.
And, of course, according to the internet reports, Nick Saban was in Texas. So, I mean, you got to take a look at that one, right?
You know, I woke up a little late, and I missed that whole conversation. You know, it was really funny because somebody actually asked myself and another one of my coworkers who follow college football pretty closely the other day. They were like, you know, so seriously, like, do you ever buy into the theory that, you know, that Nick Saban would ever leave Alabama, that Texas would just back up a dump truck full of money and offer Nick Saban? It's like, yeah, I mean, they might, you know, but I think that if Nick Saban were to ever leave Alabama, it wouldn't be for any amount of money. It would just be because he was looking for another challenge. I don't think right. That challenge would really come at Texas. I think it would come in the NFL. But, you know, I think, you know, you talk about stories kind of, you know, this year, Mac Brown is the Mark Richt of, you know what I mean? Like, he's the Mark right. Richt. Well, I think that Nick Saban at Texas is going to become this year's John Gruden to Tennessee of, like, I don't know where it started and I don't know where it will end, but right. It's certainly going to be entertaining along the way.
Yeah, I don't think Nick Saban's going anywhere. I think he's got a pretty good spot right down in Alabama. He can coach there for as long as he wants, and I think he'll be okay. I'd like you, if there is a challenge that he wants to accomplish, I think it would be another crack at the NFL. I think that would be the only way he would leave Alabama. So we'll leave that aside for now. But, yeah, I think there is a very good possibility, Aaron, at the end of the season, there could be two very high-profile coaching jobs on the market, maybe at Texas and, of course, maybe at USC, where it certainly feels like Lane Kiffin is starting to run out of excuses himself. Mm-hmm. You know, the fans chanting to have him fired at the end of the game, the way that one was playing out late Saturday night, at least late Saturday night on the East Coast. I actually did stay up to that because I was kind of glued, just like, how is this going to end? I didn't know. But, yeah, I mean, it certainly feels as though Lane Kiffin has the I don't even know how to describe it, but he's certainly running out of time, I think, to turn that program around quickly.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's no easy answer. And, you know, the thing that sticks out to me, even more, you know, the stat to me that stood out of this entire weekend, more so than the 559 yards rushing that Texas gave up, was the fact that USC, not only did they lose to Washington State at home, which is inexcusable under any circumstances, and I know that you and myself and some of the Crystal Ball Run people have gone back and forth on, you know, how much is Lane Kiffin's fault, how much is he handicapped by the – or hamstrung, I should say,
right,
by the NCAA sanctions. The thing that stood out to me this weekend, USC lost at home to Washington State when Washington State did not score an offensive touchdown.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that for a second. Like, that is unbelievable. And, again, I am, you know, one of the last Lane Kiffin apologists there is. This past weekend was kind of the first time that I really felt like, okay, the fans have a point here. I am just as frustrated as fans. I'm not a USC fan. But, you know, for a guy who is supposedly an offensive guru, an offensive genius, you know, he was the coordinator through those high-flying times with Matt Leinart and Reggie Bush and, you know, kind of that beginning of the John David Booty right. era and all that stuff. You know, not only to be so – you know, what I think was just so concerning if you're a USC fan is that there wasn't even an attempt to make a big play. And you know, I know that when you have two young quarterbacks, you know, you don't want to, you know, just leave them out to dry. And, you know, you maybe don't want to challenge a team downfield. But it's like you have the best wide receiver in college football. You've got to at least try to throw the ball downfield a few times. And it's like, you know, USC fans, a lot of their frustration is with the bubble screens and with the runs up the middle. And, you know, by the way, lost in all this is that Trey, you know, Trey Madden is having a fantastic year and is kind of the one guy just playing with an angry chip on his shoulder and all that. But to me, again, I just think that it comes down to, like, you've got to diversify this offense. And if you're an offensive guru like you claim to be, Lane Kiffin, you've got to do better than that. And I don't care if you've got two true freshmen starting a quarterback. I mean, look, Texas Tech is playing a walk-on true freshman, okay?
Yes.
So you can't use the excuse of these guys are young, we need to give them time to mold into the offense, all that. You know, that's all well and good, and I understand that. But you got to put up more than three. You got to put up more than 7 points, man. Like, you just have to. And so, in terms of USC fans being frustrated, I can't say that as we kind of look back on this past weekend that I disagree with them. And you're right. I mean, you look at this schedule. Things better turn around quickly, or you know, Lane Kiffin's going to be out of a job at the end of this year. I mean, I don't know if you can't beat Washington State at home. I just don't know where the wins come from. I don't think that any team on the schedule, except maybe Stanford, is a team that USC is incapable of beating.
Right.
But if they don't get I take that back. I forgot that they have Notre Dame on the road, which is obviously a huge, huge game. But I don't think there are any teams that USC is incapable of beating. But if they kind of play scared, if they play intimidated, if they don't open things up a little bit, it's going to be a long season, and you just kind of wonder where the wins are going to come from.
Yeah, you really do. And, you know, especially at a time when it looks like UCLA has started to turn a corner, and obviously they played in the Pac-12 championship game last year, winning that division outright. You know, UCLA looks like they're starting to take a little bit back at USC, and it comes at a perfect time for their program. And then you look at what some of the other teams in that division, you know, Arizona State, Arizona, you know, interesting teams to keep an eye on, you know, Utah and Colorado, it's a different story, but it's not exactly an easy division the way that maybe people had envisioned when these divisions were split in the Pac-12. So they've got a lot of work to do. You know, one of the questions we're kind of debating back and forth behind the scenes of Crystal Ball Run, and again, we're going to be sharing this this week. You know, which program is going to be capable of turning things around faster in terms of becoming a player in the national championship picture? You know, obviously maybe not this year, but as we get into the college football playoff era next year, you know, which one of these programs is going to have the first shot at making a run at that championship picture?
Well, I think it's Texas, and I, you know, I think you just hit on a really important point that I don't think people fully appreciate, is that, you know, this Pac-12 that we're in right now, this is not the Pac-10, Pac-12 that Pete Carroll ran through, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago. the thing that most impresses me, I will argue, you know, people say that the Big 12 is the most balanced league from top to bottom. I think you could make the case that there are more really good teams, maybe not great teams, but really good teams in the Pac-12 than in any other league in college football. I mean, you look across the board. You mentioned UCLA. I mean, they went from, you know, couldn't get out of their own way to, I think everybody agrees that they're probably one of the 15 best teams in the country this year. Arizona State is a dark horse, you know, Pac-12 South. Possibly, I don't think they're a Pac-12 championship contender, but I think they can win this division. You know, they have a very interesting game with Wisconsin this weekend. Arizona is improved under Rich Rodriguez. Colorado, I know they're terrible. USC, everybody should still beat Colorado, but they're going to put up points under Mike McIntyre, and that's an up-and-coming coach and an up-and-coming team that I think has potential for the long term. Oregon, we know what they are. They're a national championship contender. Stanford's a national championship contender. Washington is much improved. Cal looks to be better under Sonny Dykes. Oregon State started the year ranked in the top 25. So you just kind of look across the landscape of that conference, and there are so many really good teams, and that, more than anything, is why I think USC, along with the obvious NCAA sanctions, is going to struggle to get back into that national picture. Can it change? Yes. A lot of things happen in college football year to year, month to month, day to day, that change these things. Eventually, USC will be off of probation. Eventually, they'll probably have a different coach who will kind of get things going in the right direction. But when you're only allowed to recruit 15 players a year, you're only allowed to sign 15 players a year, and everybody else is at 25, and you're not going to have a full complement of players until, you know, whatever it is, 2016, 2017, 20, whatever it is. I just think it's going to be really hard for USC to compete, especially with all these other teams getting better and all of these other teams kind of starting to be on an equal footing with USC in terms of facilities and resources and money and all those things, because USC 6-7 years ago had financial, financial just benefits that these other programs didn't have. That changed with the Pac-12 network, that changed with the Pac-12 TV contract. And I just think that USC is going to have trouble ever, or at least for the very foreseeable future, ever getting back to kind of a national championship contender year in and year out the way they did. I don't feel the same way about Texas. I think Texas can be right back there. As I said, they won 9 games last year. They're not that far off. And that's kind of where I stand on that. But I think that you kind of brought up the big point with USC in terms of how strong the Pac-12 is. And, you know, it's going to be tough for USC going forward.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a quicker turnaround for – let's just assume that each program has a new coach, whoever they may be, going into 2014. Again, that's an assumption. That's just a hypothetical situation right now. But, I mean, I think it will be an easier job to get Texas back into the mix for all the reasons that you laid out. The sanctions that USC is still going to have to play through, the after effects of the fact that, you know, Texas plays in a little bit more of a – I guess a wide open conference that where it's not going to take a whole lot to get them back into the mix. And again, I'm not saying that they can't make a run this year because there's so much football to be played, but it just doesn't look good right now. But we'll see what happens as the season plays out this year. Again, I think Texas is going to have the easier turnaround if they have the right coach. And I think that's what it all comes down to for either program. But Aaron, before we start wrapping things up a little bit, let's take a quick look to the weekend that's coming up. And of course, there is a huge game that I think a lot of us have been looking forward to since last November. It involves your two-time BCS champion Alabama going to Texas A&M, home of last year's Heisman Trophy winner Johnny Manziel. It is a huge game in the SEC West. Both teams are undefeated. Alabama's coming off a bye week, so you have to figure that Nick Saban's going to have quite the game plan to exact some revenge this weekend in College Station. What do you think about this one?
I don't see Alabama losing this game. I mean, I just don't. Like, you look at the fact that besides it's Alabama, besides the fact that, as you mentioned, they have a bye week, besides the fact that, you know, A&M has struggled on defense these past couple weeks. Like, I just think that Alabama, they can talk all the Nick Saban jargon that they want about taking it one game at a time and focusing on the opponent ahead and how their sole focus was on Virginia Tech. But, like, when you see pictures of Alabama's weight room in June and the Texas A&M game is running on a loop, you cannot tell me that this game does not mean more to Alabama. I have concerns about some things with Alabama big picture in terms of their offensive line. You know, just didn't seem to be as fluid. And that, you know, that happens when you lose, you know, four really good players off the offensive line. I believe three of those guys were, you know, first or second round draft picks last year. I don't think Alabama is invincible. I don't think that they're unbeatable. But I just think with everything that's on the line this weekend, I think that they're going to come out, get the win. I don't think it's going to be Johnny Football's fault. I think he's going to play a good game. I just think Alabama, I just don't see them losing this game.
I agree with you. A lot of people were looking at that first game Alabama played against Virginia Tech, and maybe just people were expecting. I think they suffered the same kind of anticipation that Jadeveon Clowney had going into this year, where we're just expecting pure greatness every time they run a play. That just doesn't happen, even for the best teams out there, and even if in Alabama going into the game. So I really do feel, though, that getting that week off, like you said, in the offseason, watching that Texas A&M game on loop in the training facility, the mindset is going to be there for Alabama. And when they have that that mission in their eyes, they're going to be very tough to beat, and I would not want to be lining up against them. So we'll see what happens in this game. I think it's going to be, obviously, it's going to be a lot of fun to watch, I think, for just a general college football perspective, giving all of the importance and all the storylines, because there are so many storylines you can go with this game. You can talk about Johnny Manziel, who's going to have his own camera following him the whole game.
Yeah.
You can talk about, you really, you know, another chance where it looks like AJ McCarron's getting overlooked once again. What does this guy have to do to really get some kind of the spotlight out there?
What does AJ McCarron have to do? If he wins another national championship, I don't think he'll care that much. I mean,
well, yeah, that's true. I'm not saying he doesn't strike me as a guy that is starving for the spotlight, but I mean, I just feel like this guy has won two BCS titles. It just feels like he should be getting a little bit more, maybe individual recognition. You know, I don't know what his NFL draft stock's like. Maybe that's what people are looking at. And again, I don't know if he's going to be a first rounder or a seventh rounder, or if he's going to be undrafted. But I mean, the guy has been a proven winner so far.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I actually picked AJ McCarron to win the Heisman Trophy. So, you know, I definitely, as much as anybody, believe in his abilities. You know, and, you know, this is kind of like the typical Nick Saban quarterback, Nick Saban leader. You know, I mean,
it really is.
He really is, right? I mean, yeah. He doesn't put himself in the headlines. You know, he doesn't, you know, let's be honest. Let me put it to you this way. How about the fact that the guy was dating Miss Alabama? And nobody knew it until Brent Musburger pointed it out. I think that you know, I mean, you think about like back to say Matt Leinart 6 or 7 years ago. I mean, that guy was a college football player. This was pre-Twitter, kind of the voracious media that we have now. And we knew about Matt Leinart's dating life. We knew about Tim Tebow's dating life. Like, you know, or the questions were certainly asked about Tim Tebow, I should say.
Right.
And, you know, so the fact that this guy just kind of keeps to himself, just wins games, puts up great stats, by the way. I mean, what was it, 30 touchdowns, 3 interceptions last year? Like,
yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know what he has to do to get the attention. But like I said, you know, if he wins 3 national championships as a starter, 4 in total as a college football player, and then rides off into the sunset with his supermodel girlfriend, I don't think anyone's going to be feeling too bad for AJ McCarron.
There are some other interesting games that we'll be talking about on the website all week, of course. We talked a little bit about the Oregon-Tennessee game earlier, but some of the other games, it's a really interesting lineup. We got some Big Ten versus Pac-12 matchups. You got Nebraska versus UCLA. Two of them played a pretty fun game last year. Washington at Illinois all of a sudden looks pretty interesting to me. Wisconsin at Arizona State. Ole Miss at Texas in a Big 12 SEC game. You know, I'm really curious to see what's going to happen with this Texas defense, because if they don't turn things around quickly this week, they could be in for another long night, I think.
Well, you know, what was the biggest complaint about Texas last week is they couldn't tackle.
Right.
Well, you talk about a team that makes you tackle, and I know it's cliche to say, but it's true, that makes you tackle in open space. Like, I don't think that there's a team in college football outside of maybe like Baylor and Oregon that make you tackle in open space more than Ole Miss does. So if you had trouble against BYU, which by all means is not an offense that is as dynamic and as versatile as Ole Miss is, you know, I am curious to see what Texas is able to do there. I don't know if you have any kind of bigger picture thoughts, but that's just the thing that stands out to me. Like if Texas couldn't tackle against BYU, I don't know what kind of chance that they have against Ole Miss this weekend.
Yeah, I really don't. And what really is kind of interesting about Ole Miss is they're also a good start, and they already have young players taking on, finding their roles. And that, to me, speaks volumes about the recruiting that they've done. And it tells me that they're on the right path. And I think that's really all you can be looking for out of them this year. If they can pull off the win at Texas, I think they would be, what, 3-0? That's a pretty good start for them.
Yeah, 3-0 with an SEC road win.
A win at Vanderbilt.
Yeah, an SEC road win and a win at Texas. I don't care how Texas is playing. That's an impressive start. And, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who covers Alabama, and he was saying that of every team in the SEC that he feels like can be on equal footing with Alabama going forward, and maybe not in the SEC, but in the SEC West. You know, obviously LSU is the obvious answer, but he right. said, I think it's Ole Miss, man, because the thing is, with A&M, we still need to see kind of what they do post Johnny Manziel. And mm-hmm. also the question becomes, you know, we've heard rumors that the NFL is already interested in Kevin Sumlin. You know, if they go 9 or 10 wins this year again, does Kevin Sumlin all of a sudden start getting that interest from the NFL?
Hugh Freeze, or you know what? I'll throw another one at you. How about Kevin Sumlin to Texas?
You know, that was it's funny because that was actually my first thought when this Mac Brown situation went down yesterday was like if you're Kevin Sumlin, why not? Like you just won 11 games at Texas A&M. I'll tell you what, you know, we've spent the last hour talking about this, but it's a lot easier to win 11 games at Texas, year in and year out than it is at Texas A&M. And that's not to say that what they did last year wasn't special. That's not to say that they don't have talent. It's none of that. It's just that it's really hard to win a lot of games in the right. SEC. So, like, to me, if you're Kevin Sumlin and you've got to deal with these snotty-nosed 19-year-olds, you know, in a really tough league where you got to play Alabama and LSU every year, or you can go make even more money in the NFL, and instead of having to put up with a Johnny Manziel, you just have to cut him. I don't know why Kevin Sumlin doesn't at least entertain the offer. And to kind of my bigger point was that, you know, Ole Miss is recruiting like really, really, really well. So you talk in terms of a program that could be a perennial top 15 team in just 2 or 3 years, especially kind of, as you said, as these young players like Robert Kimbiche and Laquan yeah. Treadwell and guys like that develop, like Ole Miss is right there, and they're certainly not there yet, but I don't think they're as far off as a lot of people think they are. And Hugh Freeze, I'll tell you this, you know, in a profession where guys kind of change jobs and they're always looking for the next big opportunity. And, you know, you look at somebody like Manny Diaz, you can't really blame him because, you right. know, you can go from being the next big thing to unemployed very quickly right. in this That's profession. Right. But, you know, Hugh Freeze said it when he took the job, and it's true, is Ole Miss is really that guy's dream job. I mean, he grew up in Mississippi. His first coaching job in the professional ranks was as kind of a recruiting coordinator at Ole Miss. You know, to me, I think he's going to be at Ole Miss as long as Ole Miss wants him, which is a really long time. And, you know, and I think that they can be right there. And I think it's going to be really interesting just to kind of see this program and certainly in the long term, but also just in the short term against Texas this weekend.
Well, Aaron, I know it's going to be another fun weekend of college football. I feel pretty confident in saying that. A lot of good games on the schedule. And, you know, hopefully we're going to be able to do this once a week and really kind of recap the things that we saw, what we learned, and really take a look into the next week. So hopefully we can do this again next week.
Kevin, I really appreciate you having me on. It's always good talking football with you. And as you said, I kind of hope that we're able to do this every week, man.
Aaron, remind people, how can they follow what you've got going on? I know maybe you're not as active on Twitter these days now, but you know, what can people look forward from you moving forward?
Sure. My Twitter handle is Aaron, A-A-R-O-N underscore Torres, T-O-R-R-E-S. Still going to try to contribute a few times a week over at Crystal Ball Run, including this podcast. And then even though I'm behind the scenes as one of the show writers, if you get a minute, Fox Sports Live every evening, 8 p.m. Pacific, 11 Eastern time. You know, we're just trying to carve a little niche into the late night sports offerings. And, you know, there's a lot of good shows on the air. And, you know, I think that there's been a lot said about, you know, some of the other shows on the air, but there's a lot of good programming on late at night, and I think we got a pretty good show ourselves, and really proud of the people that I work with and the things that we've done in a short amount of time. So check out Fox Sports Live if you get a minute as well.
Absolutely, Aaron. I know we'll probably have a lot to talk about with our next podcast, but maybe one day we'll get a chance to maybe even give us a little bit of a look behind the scenes, see what your daily routine is like over there at Fox Sports 1. You know, hopefully we can do that. So just a reminder, everybody, you can, I'm Kevin McGuire. You can follow me on Twitter at Kevin on CFB. And, of course, follow Crystal Ball Run at Crystal Ball Run. Again, like it on Facebook at facebook.com/CrystalBallRun. And, of course, the website is CrystalBallRun.com. Aaron, always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend. For everybody at Crystal Ball Run, hopefully we'll have you back next week for another podcast, and it should be a lot of fun.